The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this special Wednesday edition of the Space Show. Thank you all for tuning in and for joining us. For those of you that are listening and wondered why we weren't doing the Tuesday program and you didn't read the newsletters, it was because I figured everybody would be glued to election returns and they wouldn't be thinking about space, just like most of our politicians don't think about space. So we moved our program this week to Wednesday, and thank you all for being here. A couple of quick announcements. The toll-free number, if you would like to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. Now, the toll-free number is not yet set up because I want to allow our guest a little bit of time to put forth some of his comments, his ideas, and the premise of tonight's show. I will shortly announce when that line is available, and then you're free to call in and use it. Remember, no call screeners. Let it ring until I'm able to answer it, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I will also hold you over a break, or I will answer the call during a break, so don't let an upcoming break defer you from using the toll-free line. Email is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. And as I've been announcing on the past two shows and explained in detail on open lines, there is no chat for the time being. I was requested to discontinue it because it is distracting to many of the listeners, because many of the other listeners and the guests, well, not the guests, but many of the other listeners use it as a chat room. And since I'm a guy with no boundaries, I get engulfed into the chat sometimes, and that's distracting. So email is fine. Toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. No chat. Don't use it. You won't get a response. The Space Show is trademarked and copyrighted and registered to the Space Show, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and myself. You are free to download shows and share them and copy them and pass them around, link to them, all of that cool stuff. Don't do anything commercial. Do not edit any of the shows, and no private YouTube channels or anything like that. If you have cool ideas for what you'd like to do with a particular program or space shows in general, I would love to hear them. So please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're podcasting. We thank Andrew over at gigadial.net who does that service for us. You'll find the RSS URL to subscribe to the podcast on our website and both of our newsletters. We are in Podcast Alley, iTunes. Search for my name or The Space Show. AstroSpaceNow.com, which is in South America, YAstro.com, which is in the United States, and a host of other places. If you're interested in linking to our podcast, please contact me. Our website, thespaceshow.com, remember that our comprehensive newsletter is uploaded Sunday evening or Monday morning, California time, and it is very detailed, has all of what's happening during the week, has all of the guest bios, and it has a future event section. And if we need to change the schedule or modify something or make an announcement, this is where you're going to find it first. You can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter. Just send your note to drspace@thespaceshow.com or use the pop-up window on the website, and we'll be happy to enter your very short, very concise subscription to that email newsletter. It won't clutter up your email box at all, I promise you that. And it goes out early Monday morning, California time. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website. You can freely download the shows. This goes back to 2001 for our first Space Show program. We have a store on our website. You'll see it listed as Space Show Gear, Check it out, please. And, of course, the most important thing there is support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org. You can find out about our projects that we're looking for funding for by going to One Giant Leap. Order lots of books through Amazon, through our partnership with them, from the guests that are on the show. And if you pay United States taxes, you do get a tax deduction by donating to the Space Show, One Giant Leap Foundation. You'll find the PayPal links on both the Space Show website and the One Giant Leap site, or you can contact me for special donations or for checks or something of that nature. Hold the dates. I really only have one left for this year, but if you know of something else I should be announcing, please tell me. This is the Japan-U.S. Science, Technology, and Space Applications Program Symposium. It is November 14th through the 18th. At the Fairmont Orchid Hotel and Resort. It's in Kuala Coast Island, Hawaii. They have a website, justsap.org/2010. Again, if you have other things that you think I should be announcing and bringing listeners to the attention of, please let me know. Remember, the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more info, visit their website, which is secureworldfoundation.org. And then finally, remember, we have the Space Show blog. You can comment on all of our programs, even rate them if you want. You can upload material that is relevant to the show. If it's not relevant to the show, I will take it off. But go ahead and use it. And it is http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And this show gets archived there as well as at thespaceshow.com. So, everyone, I am very pleased to introduce a new guest to the Space Show this evening. And I've been talking with him a couple of times before this show took place. And I know we're going to have an informative, exciting, and very good show together. I want to introduce everybody to Greg Cecil. Not only has he been a space enthusiast since he first watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon when he was about 6 years old, he then had a 22-year medical career. He returned to school at the young age of 40. He got his degree in aerospace technology from Brevard Community College. And 3 months after graduation, he was hired by USA, United Space Alliance, to work on the thermal protection system for the shuttle fleet. During his 5.5 years at Kennedy Space Center, Greg obtained 3 more degrees, including his master's in aeronautical science, space operations management from Emory-Riddle Aeronautical University. And let me just give you a couple of highlights. His full bio will be up on the website. But during his time at Kennedy Space Center, Greg has partnered with the NASA Biomed Division and conducted a study on the feasibility of using Crew Physiology Observation Device, which is a high-tech monitoring system developed for the astronauts for other tasks and personnel at Kennedy. He was one of the first 100 people to obtain the National Certified Aerospace Technician program offered through Space Tech, which is www.spacetech.org, one of 75 scientists, engineers, and technicians selected to participate in a month-long class on microgravity, culminating in a flight on zero-G. Anyway, the list is on and on and on. The bio is already up on the newsletter, and it will be in full on the website when this program is archived later this evening or very early in the morning. Time to talk to Greg rather than read about him. Welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Dr. Levinson. How are you?
Please call me David, okay? And,
okay, David.
And if you get real frustrated, other names are welcome, too. So.
I get enough of those.
Don't we all these days? Don't we all?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and you, by the way, have a very cool website and that I would really suggest all of you visit. It is www.rv-103.com. And I guess the starting point is, how do you get a website at rv-103.com? You want to give us the significance of that?
In October 2009, I elected to take the first round of layoffs at Kennedy Space Center. And one of the dreams that my wife and I have is to RV across the country and see a bit of our great nation. So we purchased an RV, and it's a Class A mobile home. And when it came time to name it, you know, guys, we got to name our vehicles. I wanted to keep touch with what I did at Kennedy Space Center, and the very first ship I ever worked on at Kennedy Space Center, and still my favorite ship, is Space Shuttle Discovery. And the official NASA designation for Discovery is Orbiter Vehicle 103, or OV-103, so hence the name RV-103.
Why is Discovery your favorite one, other than it being the first one you worked on?
That really is the reason. It was the first one. I spent probably several months working on it. I spent probably close to a year working on it before it went on its first return to flight, and then moved on to work on Atlantis and Endeavor. That's what they do, is once one shuttle is finally out on a mission, then they move the crew that was working on the shuttle to the shuttle that's next up and assist that crew in getting them ready.
They all look alike to us, so you've heard that statement before, right?
There's subtle differences, I think. Just sometimes in the pattern of the tiles or the pattern of the blankets, I think you end up noticing that. If you spend enough time around it, you can tell Discovery's the oldest ship compared to Endeavor. To give you specifics, I really can't. It's just a general feeling or view when you're just working on it up close, and you start to notice just little subtle differences about it. And it may be also the fact that they're in different bays, and that adds to the differences too.
What was it like working on Shuttle, and, kind of take us into your world, okay?
First of all, it's living my dream every day. I literally would get up in the morning, kiss my wife, and say, I'm going to go work on my spaceship. And there's not many people in the world who say that. And it was a happy place to work. I've worked in hospitals and as a paramedic and various different places, and it is probably the happiest place to work when it comes to the workforce there. They enjoy their job. They believe in the dream of human spaceflight exploration. But our typical day we would show up at work in the morning, and first thing we would have is our first line manager would have a staff meeting. And we'll talk about any issues of the day or anything that's been handed down from up on high. Sometimes hand out some posters or patches for a flight that's coming up or a flight that just went that involved our ship. And after the meeting usually lasts 20, 30 minutes, and then we report to our shops. And for thermal protection system, we had three shots. We had forward, mid, and aft TPS. And I started out in the mid-body TPS, went forward for a while, and then went back to mid-body when I was working on the ship. And then eventually I was transferred into what we call the carrier panel room, which is where we process the carrier panels for the space shuttle. It was my job to inspect them and to seal them for flight, and then the seal will be broken when they're ready to install them on the one of the three shuttles right before flight.
Now, what can you describe? Several of us may not know. What do you mean by carrier panel?
Carrier panel is a hatch or access door. It may be just something bolted on, or it might be an actual door. Excuse me. And it's covered in thermal TPS, either blankets or the tiles. And they would remove these hatches so they could get access to the interior of the ship to work on wiring, hydraulics, whatever. And those panels would be sent to the carrier panel room. They would be inspected. Any repairs that may be needed or anything like that on the thermal protection system, they would go ahead and have technicians work on that. And then it came to my bench, where I would do the final inspection and make sure all the hardware is there to attach the panels back on the ship. And once I was satisfied with that, I would seal them up in a box and put a lead seal on it and stamp it with my stamp. And that seal could not be broken until the vehicle guys were ready to install that panel back on the ship.
Why did you decide to take the first round of layoff and cuts on the space shuttle crew?
I think three reasons. One was I wanted to leave when things were still good. I wanted to be able to, first of all, choose when I left. And second of all, everybody was still there. It was the first round of layoffs. So it was still, you know, a very pleasant place to work. We knew the end of the shuttle program was coming, but we still kind of put that off at the back of your mind and continued on your day-to-day activities. The second thing is my wife and I wanted to go RVing, and we thought that this would be the opportunity to do it. And so that's what we did.
Listeners, I'm going to open up the toll-free line. And if you would like to call in with questions or comments, that line is available, 1-866-687-7223. Again, there's no call screener, so be patient. I'll answer it as soon as possible. You may be on hold for a couple of minutes, but you'll be there, and we welcome your phone call. Did many people go in that first round of layoffs?
No, it was only about 400 people, but the bulk of them were volunteers that went ahead and volunteered to be laid off. There was very few that were forced to go. And that was another reason, is I thought this was an opportunity for me to go, and it gives an opportunity for somebody else to stay. And a gentleman came in, I taught him how to do my job, and he did very well. And he actually got an extra year. He got laid off on this last layoff.
Did you think, let me ask you this, were you guys ready for shuttle to be retired? I mean, I know you know it was happening because it was part of the vision and the programming several years earlier. Did you think shuttle should be retired? Did you think this should be a program that remains? Did you have safety concerns about it? We hear that from everybody, you know, it's
okay.
Not going to be safe.
Well, that's about three issues there.
Yeah.
The first one, did we know or really believe that the shuttle's going to be retired? I think there were a few people that that were still in denial about it, but most of us knew, understood. When I was going for my master's courses at Embry-Riddle, I was there with a lot of coworkers that were doing the same thing, trying to improve their education and hoping to get into Constellation. And so most people, I think, were prepared or were preparing and knew what was going to happen. There's not many jobs where you get a 6 or 7 year layoff notice. And we did. As for do I believe the shuttle should have been ended, I've changed my way of thinking about that. In the beginning, when President Bush announced that the shuttle program was going to be ended in 2010 and Constellation was going to take its place, I was very, very excited because I wanted to see us go back to the moon and learn to live there. And I thought, yeah, it's time for the shuttle to end. And I wasn't working out there yet. Once I got out there, and I spent 5.5 years getting a chance to see these ships inside and out, it's probably a mistake that they're ending it. Discovery is going to go on her very final flight, which is the 39th flight. And these ships were designed to fly 100 times. And she hasn't even hit middle age yet. And now she's going to become, by the end of November, she'll become a museum piece. And that's a shame because there's a lot of potential there. That, you know, she still has 61 flights left in her. And of course Atlantis and Endeavour are even younger. So I wish we could see the budget increased to the point where the shuttles could continue to fly until we do have something to replace it. And be able to hang on to that skilled workforce out there at Kennedy Space Center. the ones that are being laid off, they're scattering to the wind. And some have went to South Carolina to work. I believe there's a Boeing plant there that they're at. And others are just going to other different parts of the country. And we're losing our workforce. They're scattering out. And that's a shame.
You know, I was at Ames with a conference over the weekend, but I get a chance to talk to a lot of people who work at NASA in different divisions, not shuttle. And, you know, the opinion about it's not safe, it needs to be retired. I mean, this is all over the board. I guess if I took a survey of all of the people that I've talked with who work with NASA in one way or another since the announcement by the administration on February 1st, I'll bet it's 50-50 on NASA personnel having at least some knowledge of the shuttle program in terms of it should be retired, it should not be retired. How subjective, and of course everybody thinks they're right, you know, always
right.
with everything. How, and we do have a caller on hold, so caller, I know you can hear me, just be patient, please. How subjective is it to cast an opinion on shuttle when you work at NASA? Do you have to be intimately involved with it like you are? Can you be intimately involved with the astronauts but not with the hardware? How does a listener know who to give, you know, more credibility to or less credibility to when they say retire or when they say keep it flying? It's, you know, to the average Joe in the street, it's, you know, it's got to be pretty confusing.
Well, I'm sure it is. And a lot of people look at it and say, well, oh my God, the shuttles are, the whole program is 30 years old starting.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
It'd be 30 years, yeah. Think of it this way. Let's take a 1981 Corvette, and you take it out of the garage for a two-week drive across the country and back. And as soon as it comes back, the tires are replaced, the engine is replaced and tuned up. I mean, it's basically torn down and inspected from nose to tail. And when it's ready to go back out again for another two-week drive, it's a brand-new car. And the shuttle, in a way, is that way. And it's also being constantly upgraded. You know, the shuttle has a glass cockpit now instead of the old dials and things that it had 30 years ago. There's a lot of other improvements that have been done. The thermal blankets was an improvement to help lessen the weight on it. And, you know, and the safety factors were like with the extra camera bin. Well, it's like taking that 1981 Corvette and installing now OnStar and installing airbags and, you know, things that were not standard back in 1981. On the outside, it still looks like a 30-year-old vehicle, but on the inside, it's very, very modern.
I do understand it has really old-fashioned computers, though, right?
Well, it does. But the thing is even our satellites up there today still have computers that are 3-4 generations back. And as long as it's reliable and works, I don't particularly see a problem with it. And I think one way they've went around it, too, is if they need more advanced computing power, they've actually set up laptop Ethernet networks inside the shuttle and get them up and running. And So I think, from my view, I think it's safer now than it's ever been. I think it's constantly modified and everything. If I could find a way to take a ride on it, believe me, I would go. I might scream all the way up, you know, out of fear, but I would have no hesitation. If they gave me the opportunity of a lifetime to fly on the final mission, I'd say, sure, strap me in.
Yeah, I'd go with you as well,
yeah.
Absolutely. Let's see who our caller is. Caller, are you still with us, please? Hello?
Yes, I am.
And who are you, please?
This is Al Kohler calling from Florida.
Hi, welcome to the Space Show.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to hear that Greg is on and doing a fine job of describing the shuttle program from his perspective and his activities in that program. I'm part of the space tech activity that helped Greg get into the program, and I have a couple of questions I'd like to hear his answers to.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I liked your idea about the the average guy and trying to get a perspective on what it's like to work at the Kennedy Space Center. And, Greg, I wondered if you might think a minute and just tell us what you like the most about that work that you've done and maybe what you like the least.
Dr. Culler, first of all, it's good to hear from you. And the thing I like the most, I think, working on the space shuttle program is being part of something that's much bigger than myself. Involved in something that actually is good for our nation, actually good for humanity. We're out there pushing science's boundaries, and, you know, here we are, we're just finishing up building a world-class research facility 250 miles up. And to know that I had a part in it, a very small part, but I had a part in it. I like that. I think that's probably my favorite part, is being part of something that is much, much bigger than myself. The part I like the least, probably the politics, both the external politics where you have to worry what the politicians are going to decide and are they going to change their mind again next year. And sometimes the internal politics where you might have different companies battling it out, trying to get a piece of the pie, so to speak, wanting to be involved. And you know, that gets a little frustrating, you know, because us little guys, we're at the mercy of all that. And so those parts I probably don't like.
Super. David, may I take another moment and ask another question?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Greg, I'm wondering, you know, one of our concerns is the next generation of people who will be the Greg Cecils of the world, coming into the work and trying to find their way in the same way that you did, in a world that might be a little more confusing in terms of where it's headed, what the next great program will be. Why the shuttle is retired and how it fits into the greater scheme of things. If you were going to advise a young person who is considering a career in space, what would you tell them about your experience and what would your advice be on how they should proceed?
First of all, I think that they shouldn't lose sight of their dream. They need to continuously be persistent about it. And there's times when I went through the aerospace technology program at BCC, especially when the loss of Columbia, the morning that we lost Columbia, you know, of course, I was very upset about seeing it happen. But later on, I told my wife, I said, I'll never get to work out there because I figured that they would start laying people off. They may even, you know, there's a possibility they could shut the shuttle program down and everything. And you do get discouraged. And you've got to try to get past that and keep trying to keep your eye on the ball, so to speak, of what you want to do. You also have to be very, very flexible. You know, some people may think that, well, if the shuttle program's gone, then it's all over. Well, that's not necessarily true. You have about 9 different spaceports, both private and both government and commercial, throughout just these United States alone. If you've got the ability to move, and you have to have the ability to think about saying, hey, you know, I could move somewhere else and try to be an aerospace technician there. And you need to stay up on the news. You need to find out that every time you may hit an obstacle, take it as a learning example and find a way to get around it. Or go off in a different direction, but that different direction still takes you on that path towards where you want to be working in the aerospace industry. And to be honest, you need to be politically aware and active. You need to, just because you're a technician does not mean that you do not have a voice and do not have the ability to write to or call your congressmen and your senators and not just yell at them. They get yelled at all the time. Take the opportunity to teach them and educate them about the space program. Most politicians don't know, can't tell the difference between the nose of the space shuttle and the tail of the space shuttle. It's your job as an aerospace technician or as a student learning to be an aerospace technician to educate them and say, look, you know, I know that these plans are on the docket right now that, that you guys are looking at. This is the plan I favor and this is why. And let them know, where you stand.
Super answers,
and
Greg.
I think one more. One more thing. Don't stop learning. Get every certification you can. Continue your college education. Don't stop at a 2-year degree with aerospace technology, but build on that and keep trying to go on with your education. And I think that's pretty much it.
Pretty good stuff. David, just compliment you on the wonderful service you're doing to the country, and thanks for the opportunity to come on and ask a question.
Thanks for calling in, and I hope we're able to do a show together about space tech later on. So that's still open if you're able to do it.
I would be delighted. Thank you for the offer, and I'll continue to listen and let somebody else take some.
All right. And if you have more questions, give us another call.
Thank you much.
Thank you. So, listeners, that frees up the toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. I have an email to read to you, and then we'll take our first break. This is from Tom LaForge.
Okay.
And he says, this is Professor Tom LaForge. The phone's already ringing. Okay. Caller, you'll have to be on hold for a few minutes. This is Professor Tom LaForge, BCC Aerospace Technical Program and engineer at KSC. Greg was a late bloomer, but his spirit was a shining star. You could not discourage him. He told me when he first made his career decision to totally change from medical to aerospace, if I could just touch a shuttle someday. About 6 months after he graduated, he called me and said, Mr. LaForge, do you know what I'm doing right now? I said, no. He said, I'm walking across the wing of the shuttle Discovery. The one thing is flying, looks like ironically enough, tomorrow for the last time if the weather holds. God bless you, Greg, for all your travels. And he signed it, Tom LaForge, Project System Safety Engineer, KSC. So that's a nice testimonial for you.
Yeah, Tom was my instructor in hydraulics, and very, very enthusiastic, and he has a way of giving that enthusiasm to the entire class, and a very gifted instructor.
And,
he's working currently, he's the safety guy on the Ares 1 launch tower, and of course, right now, he's looking to see what's going to happen after this new Congress comes in. He doesn't know yet.
Nobody seems to know.
No one knows. I don't think the new Congress knows yet either. So,
well, they probably don't know the nose from the tail of the space shuttle. So.
True.
You know, who knows? Well, let's take our caller before we take our break. Caller, are you with us, please?
Yes, I am.
And you are, please?
I'm David Kranz. I'm originally from Florida area and a friend of Greg's for about 7 years now.
Go for it.
Greg, you truly have been a inspiration to a lot of people at the Space Center. As you know, that I've been gone since the last layoff. Your behind-the-scenes work in trying to drum up support for our space program and making our congressmen and women aware of the situation has been a big asset to the space community. I know personally of your situation. Of course, the audience doesn't. You're tirelessly behind the scenes with your blogs and in contact with many of our congresspeople to try to drum up support. And back to the question that was asked earlier about how do we relay the importantness of our shuttle program to those that don't understand, I don't really know if we can. I don't think people realize the importance of what we do in space and the medicine that we create and the cancers that we try to treat and so forth and so on. And it's really important that we maintain, not just for national security, but for space exploration, for all kinds of technologies that have come not necessarily directly related to shuttle, but indirectly related to shuttle programs, just as we did with, you know, with Skylab and so on and so forth. I don't know how we express this to the U.S. public and beyond, how we can really you know, if we could continue shuttle, which I don't think is feasible anymore. It's gone so far down towards retirement that it would take us years to ramp up, maybe not years, but at least a long time to ramp up production for new tanks and for external boosters and so on and so forth. But I think these shows are important to help create awareness of our situation.
You know, this is the proverbial question that I've been asking for a number of years on the space show, is exactly the question you asked, although I phrase it a little differently. And I was teaching last week at the Space Studies Department at the University of North Dakota, where I'm an adjunct professor. And the main professor there, Dr. David Whalen, was giving his talk to the students on space policy. And, you know, he was listing all the issues and the problems and what happens and how confusing and discombobulated our space policy is. And he sort of asked me for comments. The class was almost over because his presentation used up most of the class. And, you know, I unloaded. You know, there were about 20-plus students in the class. And I unloaded the way I do when I get in a rant on the space show. But, you know, because here's the problem with all this. Everybody is talking about this within our community. And it never gets outside of our community. It's like there's no closed-loop life support system yet, but there sure is a closed-loop discussion system for the value of space. And I just said, you know, until we in this community figure out how to make sure that people outside of our community and people in Congress understand the value and wealth-producing contributions of space and the importance of it, not just to the United States, but to the entire world, this chain of stuff that Dr. Whalen has been teaching the class and talking about is just going to repeat and repeat and repeat all year, all along. And it's really up to us to figure out how to take our values and understanding and our knowing. I mean, we all intuitively know it, whether we want to do Falcon 9 launches or EELV launches or keep the shuttle going. We're all driven because we know the value of space development and human spaceflight. And yet we can't get the outside world to give us 5 seconds worth of understanding, and they'd rather spend government money on BS that goes nowhere, creates zero jobs, even if you're putting $1 billion into it, trashes the biggest workforce in the entire world for space in California, which is what's going on right now. You have candidates who don't even know that space is a huge workforce in California. I mean, I can list the list is on and on and on. And try as we might, you know, we're going around in circles with our own community. And nobody seems to know how to break out of this. It is the...
David, both of you guys, I think the biggest thing is you've got to know your audience. This is an audience that's concerned about American Idol. This is an audience that's concerned about whether Britney Spears wore panties when she went out that night.
That's right, with a rocket on them, too.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was fortunate enough. You've got to look at... That's one thing I try to do with my blog is I don't make it science-heavy or try to address just the space community itself. I try to address a general audience. And hopefully, and the comments and responses I get back from the blog and some emails and stuff, I know that there are people out there that are actually listening. And it's... I know it's frustrating and upsetting, but I'll tell you, there are days I went to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Center, and I have an annual pass, and I would go and sit in the commons area, and I have hope because thousands, I mean literally thousands of people come to that visitor center, and you hear languages from all over the world, and there are children there being inspired, there are adults there being inspired, and So the interest is out there. Part of the other problem is the media doesn't want to talk about it. The media, first of all, doesn't understand it. Second of all, the media doesn't care. There are too many reporters that come to, like, Kennedy Space Center for a launch. They don't do their homework. They don't have any kind of a science degree, so they know what questions to ask. and they think it's a free Florida vacation that's been paid for by their media company. A good example of that is SDS 121, when Lisa Nowak and Stephanie Wilson went up, and they did some incredible work with the robot arm, and they trained for 2 years to do that job. And it was a New York Times reporter there, and he was on national television, and the man is wearing a simple tropical shirt, shorts, and flip-flops, representing the New York Times.
Perfect.
And he spent the first 5 minutes of this question talking about how he used to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force and his accomplishments and stuff. And he finally got around to asking the women their question. And he says, how do you keep your hair so well kept when you're in zero G?
Well, he probably knows his audience in the New York Times. What can I tell you?
But, you know, it is part of the media's responsibility to help bring that audience up instead of keeping to continue to debase their knowledge, but to actually teach and educate and inform. And I kept thinking, if I was the editor of the New York Times, first of all, my employee showing up on national TV dressed that way, representing my company, he'd be in trouble. Second of all, asking such a sexist question like that, and demeaning those women's accomplishments, I would have fired him.
Well, not at the New York Times. That wouldn't have happened. But
well, I know. But that's an example of part of where the media fails. And I mean, CNN got rid of their entire science division. Miles O'Brien got fired.
Yeah, I know. They dumped the entire science and technology division. Miles has been on the show several times as a good friend. Unbelievable that they would dump that. So, David, you were going to say something before we talked over you.
I was just going to say that. Fortunately, before I left the United Space Alliance, I was picked on a commission to the Obama administration for a roundtable on what to do with the Space Center. And part of our meeting was with one of our congresspersons and also with Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. And we discussed what to do about the economy in our area and what to do about the space program, and we all kept trying to reiterate, you know, you realize the importance of what space travel is to not just our community, but to the country. And all the administration wanted to do was, well, how can we create jobs so we can keep people happy? And I really don't feel...
Two more years.
Yeah.
I think that's what all administrations do with space.
Yeah, so nobody understands the importance of it except the people that are directly related to it.
Well, and you know, I said it in North Dakota, and I say all the time, if space is really as valuable as we in the community know it is, then we ought to fund the damn programs to get the job done and to create the wealth and create the jobs and stop with this nickel and diming it and doing everything we can to prevent it from fulfilling its potential, because its potential is a game changer for not just the United States, but for the world. And
you know, there's two things. First of all, Congress is very good about throwing out trillion-dollar stimulus and throwing money out like crazy. But when it comes time to funding NASA, they all of a sudden become budget hawks when it's only a few billion dollars. A lot of people don't realize that when we bailed out GM to get them through a three-month period, we spent what was equivalent to an entire one-year budget for NASA. The other thing I think is that we need to get the politics out. And I think that once a human spaceflight program is decided upon, it needs to be locked in place and funded for a 10-year block.
Yeah, but we don't do that with Congress.
No, we don't do that. Every time we change administrations, it seems like that we want to change everything. The only two programs, human spaceflight programs, that saw its way to final completion was Mercury and Gemini. Everything else was canceled early. Apollo was canceled early. Apollo Soyuz was a political stunt, so I don't count that. Skylab was canceled early. And we ended up losing Skylab before the Columbia could get built to go up and help boost its orbit. And now the shuttle program, whether it's 30 years or not, it's still being canceled early because Discovery is only on its 39th flight, and it's still good for 61 more flights. And if you could get the politics out, I mean, this is rocket science. Human spaceflight programs take years of investment, and they take a significant amount of money to invest. Not on a trillion-dollar scale like we're doing with the bailouts, but you need to be giving them an adequate amount of money so they can accomplish their goals. And that's not being done. And I'd love to see where they could, and where they could put a 10-year, say, okay, this is our 10-year goal, and NASA, of course, will have to come and give us updates, but this is a fixed amount of money you will have for that 10-year period. And you know, spend it wisely, but we expect you to get these goals finished within the next 10 years. And then NASA doesn't have to waste time and energy lobbying for next year's budget. They don't have to waste the time and energy wondering whether their budget's going to get cut or not. They know what is in the savings account. They know what they got to spend, and they can devote those energies and that money to getting their goals done. And, it unfortunately right now that isn't done, and that's not the way the government works. But, it's insane. One thing I saw when I worked at Kennedy Space Center was when it got close to the end of the budget year, if they had a little bit of a surplus, they'd go out and buy new office equipment and get rid of the office equipment they just bought last year. And I questioned and asked about that, and I was told that, well, if we don't spend it, we'll lose it next year. They'll say, well, you didn't need it.
You'll lose it or lose it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that's insane.
Absolutely. David, anything else from you?
No, thank you, Dr. Livingston, for the forum. And, Greg, thank you very much for the behind-the-scenes work that you do that most people don't realize it. And we'll see you on the web.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, David. Take care.
Toll-free is back available again, 1-866-687-7223. You know, Greg, if I'm going to play the devil's advocate here, because
sure.
I have a lot of friends and listeners that don't believe NASA deserves the kind of 10-year funding or program that you're talking about, and furthermore, don't believe that NASA should really be in charge of human spaceflight, that, in fact, everything should transition to commercial crew, to EELV, to Falcon 9 when it's ready, and that NASA should look at deep space exploration and far-off things with human spaceflight, like going to the NEO, going to Mars, something like that. But clearly, LEO, gets turned over, to the commercials, but NASA's track record has been so questionable that they would be appalled at your suggestion to fund them for 10 years and sort of make them the continued center of attention for human spaceflight. So what have you to say? I'm sure you've heard that those positions before, and
yeah,
people have probably posted comments about that on your blog. What do you say?
Well, first of all, it depends on the long-term goal. If you're going to say, well, we'll fund you for the next 10 years to do nothing but low Earth orbit, that's not going anywhere. That's just maintaining the status quo. If we're funding you for the next 10 years to build a fleet of ships that are going to go to the moon, build a base there, learn to live off the land, they found copious amounts of water there recently, that now you're starting to leave low Earth orbit. I think Constellation was a good plan because it had that in mind. It eventually was going to turn over low Earth orbit to commercial space under the COTS program and the other program that was going to do manned flight. I can't remember the name of it. And of course, NASA could focus on going to the moon and then eventually beyond to Mars. And I thought it was a nice roadmap. It's not perfect, but I think it was a good idea. You can't go beyond low Earth orbit till you master low Earth orbit, and we have mastered low Earth orbit. You cannot go into deep space until you've mastered the moon. In my opinion, and a couple other people's opinion, AmericaSpace.org have that opinion also, that, once we've mastered the moon, learn how to live there in a world that's only 3 days away and dealing with the environmental hazards of the constant vacuum, the solar radiation and stuff, then we can move on to deep space and exploration such as an asteroid, which I have misgivings about asteroid anyway. It's a one-time, very expensive visit, while building a base on the moon is an investment. And I know a lot of people are pushing for asteroids right now, but I don't think they're stopping to think you're going to spend billions of dollars to go to an asteroid that's just coming by in where its orbit's in proximity of Earth, and you're going to do a one-time visit, and then they're going to turn around and come back. When you go to the moon, you're going to go and learn to live there, and you're going to learn to develop tools and the materials to live there, and possibly develop a spaceport there, since there's the discovery of water. You can make your hydrogen and your oxygen for rocket fuel, and it's a lot cheaper to live, to launch in a 1/6 gravity than it is from Earth. But
what about going commercial rather than NASA building the rockets?
Well, in a way, they do that now because Lockheed and Boeing build them. I think that might describe also part of the problem with NASA. NASA has lost the dream, and they need to regain that. I think some of the bureaucrats need to go, that are more worried about covering their own positions there at NASA and their little kingdoms than they are worried about the can-do thing, and we've got to go on and do whatever has been tasked to do for whatever our nation decides our mission is going to be. Commercial companies, where they want to turn everything over to commercial companies such as SpaceX. I know SpaceX is a big thing in the news right now. And I do not want to belittle their accomplishments. They have accomplished some very great things. But in my humble opinion, they are like a Little League baseball team that just won the Little League World Series. And the Obama administration has now told the New York Yankees, we're going to disband your team and we're going to put Yankees uniforms on these kids and have them play pro ball. They're not ready yet. Now, they may be in 10 years, but they're not ready yet. And that's just my humble opinion.
So what does get ready? I mean,
first of all, Elon Musk said that he wasn't going to take any government funds, and except for what was on contract under the COTS program. And now he's changed his tune because he's looking at hundreds of millions of dollars that he's going to get from the federal government that is going to be diverted from NASA, really, to his company. And so we're subsidizing him. I'd like to see them make it or break it on their own. I mean, Virgin Galactic is going to make or break it on their own. They did Spaceship One 6 years ago. Possibly this year, it's 6 years later, possibly this year they'll be able to start doing their tourist flights. And that's fine and dandy. They want to do tourism. I think that space exploration ought to be a lot more than just tourism. But the commercial companies, I think, need to prove themselves first. They need to be launching their own human beings and showing that they can safely send someone up and bring them back safely. And they haven't done that yet. And they're already standing there with their hand out, expecting to be given that Yankees uniform to go play pro ball.
But number one, their contracts are fixed price rather than cost plus, as far as I know. But or a Space Act agreement. But the other thing is, they're getting massive oversight from NASA on carrying crew. So they're not doing it in a vacuum.
They are. And to be truthful, they don't understand just how much oversight they're going to get.
Tell us about that. What is NASA?
Every nut, bolt, and screw will have to be counted. NASA will be all over them. And I remember Elon Musk used to complain about the regulations out of Cape Canaveral Air Force Station just to go through all the paperwork to be able to launch a rocket. He has no idea what it's going to be like when NASA starts watching over them.
Well, you don't think a new NASA administration like they have now will minimize that type of oversight?
No. Bureaucrats like oversight. And first of all, they do. And second of all, when you're talking about a substantial investment by the U.S. taxpayer, the space shuttle is a good example. It's a $2 billion spacecraft. You need that kind of oversight.
Wait a minute.
You know where every nut, bolt, and screw came from.
Wait a minute.
Was put on, who did it, and things like that, because that's the taxpayer's investment.
Greg, at $200 million a day, our government is spending close to $2 billion to go to India in a week.
I know.
So, wait a minute. Let's put this let's put space and the space shuttle in this in context. You're talking about how significant $2 billion is for spending on a space transportation system, be it Falcon 9 or Atlas V or the space shuttle. And these guys are blowing nearly $2 billion to go to India for close to a week.
Well, like I said, when it comes to other things, they'll spend money like a drunken sailor that's in port for the weekend and has been 6 months at sea.
So think what we could do with that, too.
NASA, they are absolute budget hawks. They'll pinch every single penny they can. It's ridiculous.
Think what we could do with that $2 billion going into Falcon 9 or Atlas or Shuttle or anything.
Yeah, I know. It would be fantastic. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize, they hear the billions that's spent for NASA. I think, what's their yearly budget now, about $19 billion?
Well, that's proposed. It's been around 18.5, 18, something like that, yeah.
Okay, and they hear that, and they say, oh, my, $19 billion. And
half of 1%.
Yeah, it's a half a cent of every taxpayer dollar paid out. For every single dollar I pay, if I pay at 100 pennies, and I did that at a lecture one time, I got 100 pennies out, and then I took out paramedic shears. They cut through just about anything. And I cut a penny in half, and I said, this is what your $1 you pay in taxes, this is what pays for NASA. What pays for your space program.
That's a good visual. You have a caller on hold. Caller, are you with us, please?
Yeah, David. This is Gary. Can you hear me all right?
You're on a speakerphone. Can you dump it and go on a regular phone?
Sure, hold on.
Now can you hear me better?
Yeah, much better. So it's Gary, right? Where are you?
Kansas City.
Okay, go for it.
Well, you know, I want to offer my congratulations to the San Francisco Giants for winning the World Series, Dave. You know, I'm sure the Bay Area is a very exciting place Monday night.
Yeah, they had a really cool parade today. About 300,000 people showed up. I didn't go to it. I couldn't stand being around that many people. But if listeners are really interested and they want to see that, the Giants, then go to sfgate.com. And that's the San Francisco Chronicle website, and it's all over the first page. But thank you for noticing that.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, I quit paying attention to baseball since the last strike, since 91, so, but every once in a while I check in and see who won the World Series, so congratulations for that. And,
okay.
And then also, I would like to, I mean, I would later talk about the EELDs, and I would like to mention, you know, I go into a bar, and I don't get on them very often anymore, but every once in a while I see comments like, well, you know, for $9 billion we spent on the Constellation program, we could have had 30 Atlas V flights, you know, to be able to assemble a spaceship in orbit. And I try to point out, comments from people, the proportionality of that, and why, you know, that just simply doesn't add up. You know, I also cite links like Andrew Zapata, who's the director of the shuttle program. He wrote a paper, commentary about how the false equivalence of trying to compare an ELD program to the space shuttle program and why you can't really just compare costs. And, I wanted you to get a comment on that. You know, why people think that an ELD program is going to be able to replace the space shuttle program and provide low-cost human access to LEO.
Any comments on the EELB program, Greg?
Yeah. First of all, Gary, thank you for calling in. It's good to hear from you. The EELB program, those are expendable launch vehicles. And first of all, they're designed to be expendable launch vehicles. They're designed to have a non-human cargo. That's what their designation is. And to make them human-rated, they have to put a lot of triple redundancy systems in, what I understand, and then that means you're changing their design altogether. I guess the best way to say is if you you take a automatic, let's say you take a wagon to haul cargo, and then you want to change the design. And that's what it was designed to, you know, pull the wagon and pull a bunch of cargo with it. And now you want to design it to have a human being ride on it. well, you've got to change everything. You've got to put a seat in there. You've got to put in a way of propulsion, either have a horse pulling it or have an engine or whatever. That means also, since you're going to have a human riding it, you're going to have to probably change the tires, the shock absorbers, things like that. There's a lot of modifications because you're taking something that was originally designed for non-human cargo that now has to take human beings. And, you know, you're going to, with a EELV, I mean, you're going to have a life support system. You're going to have triple redundancies on a lot of your systems that usually is required by NASA in case there's one problem. If one system goes down, there's at least two other systems that can take up the slack and protect the human crew. And a lot of people don't realize it. They just think, oh, well, it's a rocket. And, you know, we just put a person up on top of it. Well, you know, if it's that rocket's designed to carry only satellites, you've really got to make a lot of changes to so it can carry human beings. Does that answer your question, Gary?
A lot of the critics that are on the bar, they emphasize the launch cost of these rockets. And what they don't really pay attention to is literally EELV rockets or medium range rockets. And their launch cost, well, you know, some of them you can see, you can try to calculate based on what Air Force contracts offer up, but the real cost and the payload cost are never really included in that. You never actually see what the real cost is. And that's one of the things that Mr. Zapata tried to point out, that the true cost of the EOB program has never really been revealed, and the launch cost for this program, for each of these rockets, is very much up for debate. So I point out, like, the Atlas V Heavy has never been flown. It's never had a launch yet. So I question why people think that an EELV is going to be a better alternative to the Constellation program. I don't know. I don't see that happening.
I don't either. Excuse me. And, you know, it's comparing apples and oranges, really. You know, you're trying to compare an entire rocket system that's designed for a non-human cargo and then saying, well, it can take human cargo, and people don't understand that. That means you have to fundamentally change the design of that rocket. And, but it's up to people like you and me and Dr. Livingston to educate folks about that. A lot of people don't know, very much about aerospace or human spaceflight. And I consider that when they ask questions, I consider that a teaching opportunity.
Yeah, and the other thing to point out is that even if commercial companies do eventually get up in LEL, and I think it's more likely going to be in the 2016-2017 timeframe if they continue to proceed, even if they do, they certainly will not ever have the kind of capabilities that the space shuttle had, and they certainly not have the capabilities of going into deep space at that point, or complete deep space missions. So, you know, I point that out, that it's not, the Constellation program was focused on developing a space infrastructure for deep space missions, and not just going into LEL. And that's one of the, you know, I'm a Democrat, and I'm very disappointed in the decisions that the Obama administration took in canceling the Constellation program. And I spent over a year and a half ago when the Odyssey Commission was formed, and people were saying, well, the Constellation program is going to cancel it. I pointed out it didn't make any sense politically, because if Obama canceled the Constellation program, he was going to sabotage the Democratic politicians in key states like Florida, Texas, California and Ohio, where, you know, there were critical battleground states for the election, and it just didn't make any sense politically. And now we're seeing that play out. I mean, we're seeing what happens to people like Alan Grayson, who's a political firebrand. I mean, he got tossed out of office. Many of them were employees in the state program.
Gary, I got to move on and take a break. Okay. Anything else?
No, that's it, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
Thank you for calling, Gary.
Listeners, we're going to take a break, but I have a quick email to read to you first.
Sure.
This is from Al Thomas, and he said, this is the shop and the crew that Greg worked with at KSC. This is Al Thomas, and I would just like to say that, Greg, we missed you quite a bit. It has just not been the same since you left the mid-body shop. Just to let you know, we are all working on Space Shuttle Atlantis right now, and she wishes that you could be here to work on her as well. Greg, we do miss you. And, it came in under a different email address, but it says that this is Al Thomas.
Yeah, I know. Al was one of my leads, and that man probably has forgotten more about the shuttle than I will ever learn about the shuttle. He's a talented craftsman when it comes to working on thermal protection systems, and that's why he's a lead. I miss those guys terribly, too.
We talk about Constellation, but, I'm not one that believes that Ares 1 was the worst rocket ever designed. I know it's a maligned rocket, and many people in the industry think it was, and think because it uses SRB, it's not fit for human spaceflight. But, we're not really going to go down that road. But its costs were really, really outrageous. And I remember, and I've said this many times, I've been to a lot of conferences with NASA people talking about $1 billion-plus launch to the moon, and ultimately they want to hand all of this over to the commercial sector. There's never going to be a business case that closes with $1 billion transportation costs to get from point A to point B. And I can understand why they need to do, something different. I think we will miss the shuttle enormously because it has the capability of carrying a whole bunch of stuff up and carrying a whole bunch of stuff down. And I did a show a week ago with Dr. Bob Fitz at Marquette University, who was the PI on this NASA ESA muscle atrophy study. And he got a question in the last 20 minutes of the show about his future plans and the plans for his students. He said he was pulling out of space. That's it, done deal. His students in the biology, life sciences were no longer going to go into space because nothing can get up to shuttle. They can't get any experiments up, the funding. And again, we're on the life science side here, not your side, which is the engineering and propulsion. Funding is being cut, and that a five-year hiatus, if that's really what it turns out to be, is a death knell for a student in a graduate program because they need to be published. They need to be able to get some funding for their idea, to get noticed, to get decent work. And that if you deny access to the shuttle with any kind of reasonable kind of experiment and there's no funding for any of this, then, the life science guys will go off into a different arena. And he said it's not just happening at Marquette. It's happening at schools all around the country and again, I'm talking life science sides here. And one of the main reasons why is they can't get access with any quantity or mass to the station. And it doesn't matter if they're going up on a Soyuz or they're going to go up on an EELV. The Falcon 9 is a little bit better because Dragon can carry some stuff up and can carry some stuff down, but nothing comes close to the shuttle. And with that,
amazing.
Yeah,
I tell the kids when I go. One of the things I do is a lecture series. I go to different schools, civic groups, and stuff like that, and I tell them what it's like to work on the space shuttle. And especially when I'm at a elementary school or a middle school, you've got to talk in their language to give them an idea just how big the payload bay is in the space shuttle. I mean, I could, spout off numbers. It's so many cubic feet and all that. And
it doesn't do it, does it?
It doesn't. But when I tell them, I said, I can put your school bus inside the payload bay and still have room left over. Those kids get it.
Yeah. Let's take our break because we're more than an hour into the show, and we need to pause. So, listeners, just stay where you are. Back in about 2.5 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. And we're talking to Greg Cecil, known as Rocket Man, retired from the shuttle program at Kennedy. And Bing is on the phone. He's actually calling us from the High Bay. They're working on the TPS system for Atlantis, and he and his crew are listening. Go ahead, Bing. You got the microphone.
Hey, Rocket Man. What's up, Slice Man? Long time no hear.
Long time no hear. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. What have you been up to? You all right? How's life?
Life is going well, and we're enjoying the interview and hearing from everybody at Kennedy Space Center. You got a question, Bing, or anything you want to comment on?
Yeah, hey, everybody here has been wanting to know what you've been up to. You know, we heard on the show you got married, man. That's congratulations for all of us.
Thank you.
And, you know, Stacy's here, Mike Coates here, Paul, Moki, everybody's here.
Well, I'll tell everybody I said hey.
Even Roy Ginter's over there on second shift. Back on second shift now.
Hey, Bing, what's the morale like on Space Shuttle?
It's kind of doom and gloom. You know, we all know we're leaving here shortly, you know, and, you know, it's been a long, good ride, but, hey, it's got to end sometime, I guess.
Is it good going getting replacement jobs, or is it a really tight job market? How do you assess the future there?
I'm not really sure. You know, some people are moving away to other states or whatnot. You know, some people have went back to school like Greg did, and, you know, he got his degree, and other people have gotten their degrees here.
Do you think shuttle should keep flying?
Oh, absolutely, man. Another 30 years.
Are you comfortable with its safety?
Absolutely. There is nothing wrong with these aircraft, spacecraft.
Nothing wrong. So you'd ride on one?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and the drop of a hat. I think that, you know, the administration we got up in Washington, D.C. now, you know, they're a bunch of idiots. And, you know, they need to get their heads out of their butts, for lack of better words, and keep flying these space shuttles, you know?
Well, they cost a lot of money.
It ain't that much.
But,
as Greg said, you know, half of a percent, you know.
Half of a percent. Okay, anything else you want to say,
nope.
Bing?
Greg, good luck, you know. Good talking to you, bud.
Thank you for the call in.
Absolutely.
Hey, and thank you for your service and your work on shuttles. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Take care.
All right, Slice.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care, Bing.
Okay, so I got an email to read to you from Trent in Australia. So you may want to elaborate, or you may want to clarify, but you can't punt and run, okay? So was just listening to the show and heard Greg say that human rating on the ELV is not doable. That's fair enough if it's his opinion, but to then go on and dismiss everyone who disagrees with him as not very educated about aerospace is just absurd. David Aiken of Space Systems Lab at the University of Maryland seems pretty educated about aerospace, and his recent AIAA paper, In Space Operations, Developing a Path to Affordable Evolutionary Space Exploration, is based on the concept of human rating Delta IV Heavy, which he estimates at costing only $2 billion in non-reoccurring engineering fees over 5 years. So if your guest would like to express his opinion, fine, but don't dismiss others who disagree as being uneducated.
Well, Trent, first of all, thanks for writing, and I appreciate hearing from the other side of the world. I didn't say it's not doable. I'm just saying that you're taking a spacecraft or a rocket that has been designed for non-human cargo, and then you've got to change the intent and purpose of that rocket into a totally different design where it will take a human cargo. It's expensive. It requires a lot of changes. And is it doable? Yes, it's doable. Is it practical? My humble opinion, and it is my humble opinion, no, I don't think it's practical. It's better to design a rocket from the ground up, or a launch vehicle from the ground up, that is specific in transporting humans and cargo.
While we're on this topic, and for
sure.
Trent as well, when AIAA had their meeting in Pasadena, so this would have been 2009, I sat down for an hour and 20 minutes with Larry Price, who was the head of the Orion program at Lockheed. And toward the end of that time, this was a taped interview at the hotel there in Pasadena, I asked Larry about launching Orion on EELV or Falcon 9. So he sort of didn't address Falcon 9 because it wasn't available yet. They didn't have specs. They hadn't looked at it and all that. But he said, yeah, there isn't an issue of putting Orion on an Atlas or a Delta. But if it's done, let me see if I can do this right. It dramatically changes the mission because the profile of those rockets was never systematically made to fly humans with Orion, which is what Constellation was designed to interface and work with Orion. So part of the issues are not only the redundancy and stuff like that, but the trajectory that they're going to go on as a missile or launching a satellite is vastly different from what you can do with a human.
I'm not an engineer, but I think that the commercial rockets or that launch satellites, don't they go through a much, much higher G-force?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, totally.
And you can't just power it down or something. You have to change the parameters of how that rocket works. So the bottom line is, he said, yes, we could do it. It would not be as simpatico or in as much harmony as doing it with a rocket that it was designed to work with from the ground up. That makes common sense. But, yes, it could be done. He didn't know or have any real idea on how much time it would take to do it and to certify it and all of that, nor did he have a handle on what the kind of cost would be. When I interviewed Larry this year at AIAA, they did say that the Delta IV was probably the more likely one to use because it's quicker to get it into the pipeline to convert it. What I've said on the show from looking into this and talking to people is, yeah, there isn't any doubt that you can do it. I think when all of the thing is said and done, that converting EELV to fly humans is probably not going to be a whole hell of a lot cheaper than what it would have cost to build Ares in the first place. And I seriously doubt that it will be done any quicker because I know what's going to happen with the bureaucrats and NASA oversight. The plus side on all of this is I think that the operational side, once the EELV is operating and has demonstrated that it can operate and is doing commercial crew, I think those operations would be substantially lower in price and lower in cost than what you would have with Constellation. So I think that's the plus side. But my hunch is the development side of this and the time it takes probably would not be a whole lot different than finishing up with Constellation.
Yeah, Constellation already had 7 years of work and $9 billion invested. And that's the interesting thing is that when they announced Obama's budget in February, the very next day after they put the capstone piece, the final piece, on the Ares 1 launch tower that now sits behind OPF 3 and collecting dust.
Well,
and, in fact, somebody was, you'll see that on my website. Someone actually put an ad on Craigslist as here, nearly never used launch tower for curb pickup. And, you know, it was a very comical ad, and they eventually got pulled on Craigslist. But that's on my website.
Well, I'm supportive of going to EELV and hopefully Falcon 9. What I'm not supportive of is a cold turkey, all or nothing transition. And what we haven't really talked about, except indirectly tonight, and that really disturbs me and pees me off, is the gap that we're creating without having a capability of reaching the station or anything.
Right.
And I think from a national security and a foreign policy perspective, to become reliant on Russia to do this is really detrimental to the
$55 million an astronaut now to go up.
Yeah, but I think it's detrimental on a foreign policy thing. Remember when Columbia was down and when we had to rely on Russia, every year we did that, we had to have an exception to the Iran nuclear proliferation agreement that we had. Congress had to pass an exception because Russia helped Iran with its nuclear facility. I just think giving up our access is a foreign policy, is a potentially foreign policy disaster. And so I would not cold turkey the transition. I would find a way to keep shuttle available for American access to the station while we're developing this capability and this transition. That's kind of how I see it. But the gap has been lost in the discussion. And as you said earlier, I seriously doubt that they're going to resurrect and keep shuttle flying. I don't even know if that extra shuttle flight will be funded and flown.
I'm not sure if it will either. When I knew that the shuttle program for certain was going to end was when they canceled the contracts to their suppliers. And I knew for them to renew those contracts with the suppliers and get those assembly lines, anything from gap fillers and filler bar and stuff that deals with our thermal protection system, that they canceled the contracts with the suppliers to get them back up to snuff and get their assembly lines going again and get them meeting NASA standards again would take 1 or 2 years. And so that was my bellwether. That's when I knew absolutely for certain the shuttle program was going to end. And it's a national security risk, I think, that we don't have the ability to send our own people into space. And I do believe, I know the quote-unquote new space people claim they can close this gap. But I think when Endeavour flies next year, that will be the last time you've seen an American astronaut on an American ship for at least 10 years.
Well, I hope it's shorter than that, but I don't think they're going to close that.
I hope so, too.
Yeah, I don't.
I want to be wrong. I really do. If I'm wrong and SpaceX or somebody starts routinely flying human beings in less than 5 years, you know, I will say on my blog I was wrong. But right now, if I have to make bets, I would say it's going to be at least 10 years before we see an American astronaut on an American ship.
Well, I hope it's, you know, I'm just hoping like everybody else it is roughly a 5-year transition. But to me, because of my interest in foreign policy and
right.
security on that side, this has nothing to do with the space side. To put our foreign policy interest at risk to be subservient to somebody, to a country that we don't always agree with. I mean, yeah, we're getting along and we don't want to have fights and problems. Everybody's for, you know, peaceful cooperation and all of that. At least every rational thinking person is for that, who lives in the modern era. But, man, to give away our potential and create that foreign policy risk is a big risk in my book. And again, as I said, that's not on the space side at all. I'm talking from my foreign policy, political science interests.
Mm-hmm.
I would simply not want to see that happen. I'm getting a couple of emails, and for those of you who maybe didn't hear an earlier show or hear the beginning of this show, we are not doing chat anymore because too many of you want to use it as a chat room, and it's very distracting. And I've been getting listener complaints about it, and guests have even complained to me about it privately because they don't think that their questions and comments and the discussion are 100% on topic with what they're saying. So you can use email at the addresses I give out all the time, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can use the toll-free phone, 1-866-687-7223. And we're doing this chat-free experiment for around a month or so and maybe through the end of the year, and I'll reevaluate it. But we don't do chat rooms here. I'm one person working the show, and I don't want to be distracted from talking to my guests. End of story. So the toll-free line is available, 1-866-687-7223. Greg, what do you think when you travel around in your RV and, you know, undoubtedly someone will say, hey, what did you do when, you know, before you retired? And you say, hey, I worked on the space shuttle. You know, that seems like a natural conversation. Are they interested? Can they ask you informed questions? Do they just, you know, do it sort of perfunctory and then go on to the World Series or whatever? Or do they really want to hear comments or details or know about our space program? What's your reaction?
I think the overall reaction is they really want to hear. a lot of people that work inside the aerospace industry don't realize that most people outside in the world will never run into anybody that works at NASA, will never run anybody that worked on a spacecraft. And so when they actually do run into somebody, they see that opportunity and they ask all kinds of questions. And now the questions may not be the most informed questions, but that's, like I said, a teachable moment where you can teach them about the space program. You teach them about the importance of human spaceflight. You always try to make it a positive experience where they walk away and say, I learned something today. And hopefully they'll end up being a supporter. Yeah, I'll talk with gas station attendants. It's funny because I pull in the gas station, the RV, and I'm busy there sobbing at the pump as I'm filling up my 75-gallon tank. And the gas station attendant may notice the license plate where I said part of the space shuttle team. And they'll ask. And I'll get out my little iPhone, show them some pictures I have of when I was at Kennedy Space Center. And and that guy's going to go home, and he's going to tell his wife, his kids, his fam, his neighbors, and stuff. I ran into a guy that actually worked on the space shuttle, and this is what I learned from him today. That's the whole reason why I do the lecture series, especially with the schools. Right now we're in western New York. It's a very rural area. The chances of them getting an astronaut to come to their school out in the middle of BFE, New York, is slim to none. And so when I get to be there and get to talk to these kids, it's an opportunity that they normally would have never had. And I'll tell you right now, talking to fifth graders, that show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? It's true. they ask some intelligent questions. I've had kids asking me how come the astronauts don't get hurt by the sound coming from the launch. How do they stay in orbit? How fast the Earth rotates? I mean, these are questions coming out of fifth graders. And they have a very high interest in knowing and learning about it and learning about why we're up there and what we did and how we did it. And, of course, you have to talk with them on a fifth grade level. But, you know, they're still going to go home and tell their families and stuff and say, hey, I talked to a guy that worked at Kennedy Space Center. And up here in western New York, we had Commander Pam Melroy and Commander Eileen Collins. They came from this area, both small towns. And they became the first and second female shuttle commanders. So maybe one of those kids I'm talking to today, I always end my lecture telling them, I said, somebody has to be a technician in the human spaceflight program. Someone has to be an engineer, and someone has to be an astronaut. So why can't it be you?
By the way, listeners, shuttle has been cleared for shuttle Discovery has been cleared for Thursday's final mission. It is as Greg said, the 39th, and it is their final mission. And right now, they're targeting liftoff for 3:29:43 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So for those,
I'll be watching it on TV.
Yeah, and for those in California where I am, that's 12:29:43 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. You have an email question from Joe in Denver, and Joe says, can you give us a rundown on what happened with space-themed candidates in the Florida elections? Did candidates win who wanted to see the new space program? Did they win if they wanted the program of record? What happened with space in the election in South Florida?
I can tell you about the two candidates that represent the northern and southern half of Brevard County. One is Congressman Bill Posey, who represents southern Brevard County. Congressman Posey used to work at Kennedy Space Center in the Apollo program and, of course, was laid off and cut. And he reinvented himself and became a real estate agent and became a state legislator, and now he is a United States congressman. And he has fought very, very hard for Constellation and fought very hard for the workers at Kennedy Space Center. And they rewarded him. They reelected him.
And he's Republican, right?
Yes, he's Republican.
Uh-huh.
The other one was Congresswoman Suzanne Cosmos, who represented at Kennedy Space Center proper and all of northern half of Brevard County. She appeared, her and Senator Bill Nelson, appeared with Obama on April 15th at Kennedy Space Center, and they literally hid from the workers. When they went to do their announcement, they did it at the operations and checkout building. They had sent all the workers home with pay that day because they didn't want any YouTube moments.
Yeah, I remember reading about that, yeah.
But the prevailing feeling is that, you know, they sold out the KSC workers and by canceling Constellation. And it's not a smart thing to do to betray, and I know that's probably a harsh word and some will disagree with me, but or give the appearance of a betrayal. Let's try to be fair and say that. To give an appearance of betrayal to over 10,000 people in your district and their families. And Suzanne Cosmos lost the election last night by almost a 2-to-1 margin.
Well, did her opponent campaign on Constellation in the program of record, or was space not even brought up?
Space was brought up as in trying to get a human spaceflight program. Her opponent is Congresswoman-elect Sandy Adams. And Sandy Adams and I have spoke quite a lot. In fact, she called me one right before the Senate plan and the House plan were they were just introduced, but no action had been taken yet. And she called and we spoke for over an hour about it. And she said, you know, I don't know that much about space, but I do know this. I was at Kennedy Space Center, and I saw the Orion capsules, the first prototype being worked on. I saw the launch tower. I saw people working on it. She says, that program existed in this world. She says, Obama's plan, the House plan, the Senate plan, all existed only on paper.
So how do how do you separate NASA turning into a jobs program from having the best space program for the interest of the country?
A jobs program is to have, I guess the best way, a jobs program is to build a rocket that has no mission, no destination, no use whatsoever, but keeps people employed. A human spaceflight program is to build a rocket that has a mission, a destination, and, hey, by the way, we have to hire people to build it. That's the difference between a jobs program and a human spaceflight program.
So what do you say to the people who don't think that the program of record, the vision for space exploration, for example, the hardware being designed, was the best way to have a human program? Because I hear from people, we got to do the necessary R&D. We have to, you know, make sure that we build the right kind of heavy lifter. We need to do this. I mean, so they agree with you about human spaceflight. They don't agree with you that the VSE or the program of record is the best way to accomplish that or the best interest of the U.S. So there's a huge gap here between, you know, what you're talking about and what it seems the voters approved in Florida on the two campaigns you're talking about versus, say, what my new space friends talk about.
Yeah, there are differing views. I mean, there are people that are extremely passionate about the so-called new space and think that their way is the right way. What irritates me is there literally is a civil war going on in NASA with the people that have devoted all this energy and their belief in Constellation and these people that don't. And I understand having different points of view. I understand saying, look, maybe my way is better than your way or your way is better than my way. But what upsets me about what they have done to Constellation is for 7 years, they have been whispering in the media's ear and talked about the oscillation problem with the Ares 1, which proved to be nothing. It got to the point where they were doing personal attacks on Dr. Griffin, that ran NASA at the time.
Well, they've done personal attacks on my guests that have come on and advocated, you know, Doc Horwitz, Charlie Precourt, and others. You know, I was told that when I interviewed Charlie Precourt at ATK, that he's a damn liar. Come on, this guy is a national hero to the United States. I mean, for somebody to call him a liar, I just can't believe that people do that kind of stuff. But it's replete all through, you know, space community.
The only one I have seen that you can call a liar in this has been Obama. Because Obama stood at the Titusville town hall meeting when he realized he needed to win Florida to win the White House. And he looked at his aerospace workers in the eye, and he says, I am going to extend the shuttle program. I am going to close the gap so we can go to the moon. And then he turned around and stalked around and sneaked around at Kennedy Space Center and avoided all the workers and then killed Constellation. And for many of us, we feel he killed our human spaceflight program.
Well, for
that's the only one really I could say in this whole thing is that's been a bald-faced liar.
Well,
it's been him.
The problem with that is that...
I'm ranting.
Well, yeah, but he's a politician, and you know, he made it to the top political job, and, you know, if we all took our politicians, whether they're at state level, local level, federal level, and we put them on a lie detector test, you know, I don't think any of them would score very well. I just have a practice of discounting anything a politician says because they'll say what they want to get elected or to win their point, but you got to look at behavior, not rhetoric. You know?
Well, yeah, the only good thing that Obama did on April 15th is he took a population of 10,000 plus at Kennedy Space Center who already had probably a higher percentage of voters than what the general population does. He took them and turned them into people that became politically active.
He galvanized them.
He realized that politicians make or break the human spaceflight program and therefore affects their lives too.
Absolutely.
And they started donating, they started campaigning, they got politically active, and Suzanne Cosmas was the first victim of that.
You got it.
And I think Bill Nelson and Obama will be victims of it in 2012. I told Bill Nelson's office, I said, your boss thinks that people are going to forget when he comes around for re-election in 2012. I said, they're not going to forget. Their unemployment's going to be running out. Some will have already lost their homes. Some will have to leave their families and move out of state. And I said, there's a lot of suffering. I said, and they're going to remember Senator Nelson standing there beside Obama on April 15th at Kennedy Space Center, smiling and grinning, you know, and they're going to vote against him. They're going to campaign against him.
Well,
and Obama needs Florida to win the White House. And to win Florida, you have to win the I-4 corridor. The two anchors of the I-4 corridor is Tampa Bay and Kennedy Space Center. And Tampa Bay's upset with them because of the oil spill, and that's a whole different matter. And the other end, Kennedy Space Center, are upset with him because they perceive him as killing our human spaceflight program.
Okay.
And perceive him as lying to the workforce there.
Let me take our caller, okay? We got
sure.
A caller on hold. Caller, who are you, please?
It is Trent from Australia. How you doing?
Okay, go ahead.
I thought I'd wait until you said something that I agreed with to actually call in so that we don't have an argument. So the thing that I agreed with, and it's been a little while, I've been on hold a little while, was the actual civil war that you're talking about inside NASA. And
mm-hmm.
I cop a lot of flack from the people who, you know, think much the same as I do when I say that the people in NASA who were against Constellation and went to the media and whispered things into the ears of the media were really just out of line. Right.
Yes, they were. They crossed the line.
Yeah, I mean, you know, call me, you know, a stickler for the chain of command, but if you're in, you know, even a business or even, you know, a government agency, and you've been given your orders from up high, you don't go and talk to the media and fight your boss. You put your dedication into getting the job done.
Or you quit and then go trash the boss.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
Charlie Bolden.
One at a time. You got
to
go one at a time, guys.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
Go ahead, Trent.
To hide behind anonymity so that you don't lose your job, to me, is the height of cowardice.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I mean, I don't disagree with everything my employer does, but I shut up because you know they pay my salary.
Right. I mean, Charlie Bolden, the NASA administrator, is probably a very good example. He's not very well liked by a lot of people in the aerospace industry that because he supports and is enacting what Obama ordered.
Well, but that's his mandate.
He's an administrator, and he has to do what the president says.
Yes. I mean, that's
so,
his job, or quit. You know,
yes,
if it's
yes,
really outside your level of integrity or whatever, quit if you don't want to do what the job entails.
Right. I mean, when
I know you don't really like doing this sort of thing on air, Dr. Livingston, but, you know, I'd like to call out the people who are in the direct camp. specifically.
Well, don't call them out by...
They really were the ones. Yeah, they really were the ones who were like, I don't want to tell you my name, but I want to tell you my opinion. Right?
Right.
And it's like, well, okay, well, what's that worth then? If you're not even willing to risk your job to give that opinion, what's it worth?
You're talking about the people at NASA who were involved with DIRECT.
Right.
Yeah, which is...
That, you know, the only thing I can say, remember, when Mike Griffin was at NASA, he ran a much tighter ship on this than Charlie did or does. Yeah. And if you spoke out of turn and Mike was there, you would lose your job. So, you know, I can understand them getting on the blogs and pontificating anonymously. But then what credibility do you give it? For me, I gave it zero credibility.
But do you disagree? I mean, do you think that, you know, he should have been happy with people telling, you know, whispering lies, or even if they weren't lies?
I can't second guess. I can't second guess how Mike should have run, you know, NASA. He was very strict on towing the public line about that. I know that there were times when people were sneaking papers out to DIRECT and he forbid the use of USB, you know, what are they called, memory sticks or whatever, and things like that. You know, things, you know, because it was easy to, you know, to get stuff out, and the next thing you know, it'd be on Spaceflight Now or some other blog.
That's another thing too. They're working on the taxpayer dime, and here they are. They're undermining the what has been decided as United States
space policy
space program, and they're undermining it, and they're doing a whispering campaign and stuff. Now maybe their intentions were good, but it was still wrong to do that.
Well, I know the guys.
Policy United Space Alliance that, you know, we do not talk to the media. It is only the press affairs officer who talks to me. It's the CEO who talks to me, because the company has to give a united front. Because the media will find some guy that got mad at his boss that day, and, you know, and that guy decides to mouth off, and the media will run with it.
I've done a lot of shows with the DIRECT guys, and I think, you know, they're, not only are their intentions admirable, they're motivated, they were not in this for any money. They really believed in what they're doing, and they ran one of the best PR politicking campaigns for their ideas that I've ever come across in my life. I was willing to blow them off 100 different times, and damn if they don't sort of prevail or come close to what they're talking about as heavy lift. I mean, these guys... You know, we're exceptional in being able to market and to lobby and advocate for their ideas. And I give them credit for that.
They marketed and lobbied for their ideas. They went against United States human spaceflight policy while they were working at NASA.
Well,
and
they weren't.
Line you do not cross.
Okay, so
if you want to advocate a new system, you either advocate it within the system, or you go out to a private commercial company or something like that and pitch your work and see if they'll pick it up.
Okay, but
they did such a huge whispering campaign for 7 years. And now they, you know, it's one of those, be careful what you wish for because you might just get it. Well, now they got it. They killed Constellation.
Well, wait.
And,
the three guys that were the top guys were not NASA people. So
okay.
When you talk about Ross,
the only
and you talk
willing to risk
talk,
your job,
I mean,
yeah.
but they what they represented was, and I only have what Ross and the others represent. I don't have any real hardcore facts. Is that the design of Jupiter and whatever the other rocket were? Because they actually had a replacement for Ares 1, which was scrapped, and then they had their version of Ares 5. The design was contributed by real rocket engineering people who moonlighted and helped them out and worked for NASA. But it was Ross and Chuck and Steve who took that idea and lobbied it and made the campaign and ran that campaign. People helping on design or giving them engineering advice or things like that were in the background, and they were represented as working for NASA.
Right.
I did meet one, because when I was in Orlando, when I was at the Cape for the shuttle flight that I went to see, and I met with Ross a couple of times, and Ross did introduce me to one of the people who was advising them, who was a NASA person. I was sworn up and down to silence him. I thought I was working for the CIA or something. And, you know, I had an off-the-record, non-published, non-recorded discussion with Ross in this chat for probably 45 minutes or an hour. It was really enlightening if everything that was being said was verifiable, which, of course, I have no way of verifying it. So, of course, it never went any place with me other than it's part of my collective overall experience. But I do commend Ross and Stephen and Chuck for an unbelievable marketing, PR, and perseverance job with Congress and with key people. And, yeah, like everything, be careful what you wish for. You may get it. And
right, because now the spotlight is on them. I mean, the NASA engineers that moonlighted, they crossed the line. Whether their intentions were good or not, they crossed the line that they shouldn't have crossed.
Did you guys have rules against? Did you have rules against moonlighting when you were at NASA?
We had. Well, if you're undermining your company's mission, that's just not ethical.
No, I know, but I mean, was there a bona fide rule?
What's that?
Was there an actual rule in the handbook that says you can't moonlight?
No, there's no rule in the handbook. I mean, you might pick up a second job somewhere or something like that, but you can't go work for the competitor.
Okay.
You know, you'd lose your job over that. But, you know, I can't, you know, if I work for United Space Alliance and then somebody else is competing to get the day-to-day shuttle operations and I go and moonlight with them, I'd lose my job at United Space Alliance. If I'm going to go moonlight in something else that is not in direct competition with United Space Alliance, then they wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
But
they knew they were doing something wrong. That's why they didn't want to put their name on it.
Yeah, it is. They knew. And the thing is be careful what you wish for because you might get it because now they got it. And now that they've killed Constellation, the spotlight is on these guys, these people that have pushed for their alternate programs, the so-called new space. If they don't produce, and they're going to have to produce in 5 years or less, and if they don't produce, there's going to be people like me sitting out there saying, hey, you made a lot of big promises.
Well, I don't think what direct is new space. Trent, would you think?
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Yeah, I don't think direct is new space.
Yeah, but I guess I'm lumping it in with all the other ones.
But
you know.
the difference with direct
I think
is that
they're two camps.
They're not built.
They're two camps, and now the direct guys are going to have their chance.
Yeah, but they're not.
Have the new space guys in the background undermining them because they did it to Griffin, so why shouldn't the new guys do it to them?
Well, except the direct guys aren't building the rockets. In fact, I talked to Ross a couple of weeks ago to see if he wanted to come on the space show and talk about some of this, and they're looking for something else to do to keep their team going now that they're out of the picture, because if their heavy lift gets built, obviously it goes into, you know, the systems processing like Marshall, ATK, whoever's going to be doing it. Those guys are not the bending metal guys. They got their concept, you know, out there, and they did a fabulous job at it, and they sure surprised me because I didn't think they'd ever go anywhere. But, man, did they persevere, and I commend them for it, and I have no clue.
Well, there's a certain amount of claiming success after the fact as well.
Well, yeah, I agree
Nobody's
with that.
Nobody's actually stood up and said, this is what we're building and it's what you guys said.
Yeah, no, I
so
agree.
So far, there is no plan.
There's no shortage of bravado in the United States. So.
My question is,
I'm going to go. Anyway, thank you very much. For
thank you, Trent. Go ahead.
Thank you, Trent. Take care.
What were you going to say, Greg?
My question is because of this civil war, and that's one of my blog posts is the civil war in NASA, how much damage, permanent damage, is it going to do within the aerospace community? Because people have been very passionate on each of their sides. And like I said, I think some people have crossed the line when they should not have, and Trent was talking about that too. And there's actual damages. I mean, our human spaceflight program is now in jeopardy. People that were working on Constellation are now going to lose their jobs. So that affects them personally. And, you know, there are real casualties. And I don't know if the wounds will heal or not. I think it'll take a while. And people that have been disenfranchised because Constellation has been killed are going to be watching those other guys, and they're going to probably be the most harshest critics of them. And they're in the spotlight now, the new space guys, and they're going to have to produce, or they're going to get barbecued.
Well, you know, that if they get the funding and, you know, Congress really allows this program to go forward, then I think over time they will produce. I contend that what ultimately comes out of all of this, and again, this assumes they get the funding, probably won't be that much different in time or initial cost outlays that we would have had with Constellation. So I think commercial operating costs will be a lot lower, but who knows? I don't know. Let me ask you this question. You got a new Congress, sure. And you know, if they're, we've been asking this on the space show a lot too. If they're really serious about reducing government spending, and they're really serious about cutting back, you know, on the deficit, does NASA, because it's a half of 1%, you know, if you could cut your little penny for all of us to visually see here on the space show, it wouldn't be very much. Will it escape the red ink and the big axes of these hungry guys coming in to prove a point that we're going to reduce U.S. government spending? Or does it get the red ink along with everything else? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't think it'll escape the axe, because the first thing is that NASA is probably the most recognized and well-known government agency out there. So they'll want to make an example. So there may be spending that will be cut. Will Congress actually reduce spending? Well, first few months I think they'll try, because they're still feeling the sting from the election. But as governments go and Congresses go, after a while they start saying, well, boy, we've got a lot of money to play with. Why do we need to cut this time? Yeah. So I think you'll see token cuts, and I think one of the token cuts may be NASA, just because it is probably the most recognized government department out there.
It is highly visible over and above its one half of 1%.
Yes, it is.
You know,
and I think that's why you see the congressmen, you know, they always want to show their budget hawk. So first thing they go is they make NASA their whipping boy, and they start saying, well, you know, we you don't need all this money.
Of course,
and, about the budget.
Budgets need to be approved by the Senate as well and by the president. So this is really we're in brave new world here. By the way, listeners, remember NASA is in the discretionary part of the budget, and at $19-20 billion, it's 2.5% of the discretionary budget. So while it's a half of 1% of the total budget, it's much more visible at 2-2.5% of the discretionary budget. So keep that in mind. There's a disproportionate visibility here. You know, if they're stupid enough to cut technology development and things that NASA is known for, they're just short-sighting the future of America, the future of our education, students, inspiration, so many things that NASA is about and that space development is about. This is the kind of thing that they should be investing in, not cutting. This is where you get the bang for the buck.
That is up to getting back, that's personal responsibility. That is up to us in the aerospace community, and for anyone that is a follower of the Human Spaceflight Program, you need to teach and educate your congressmen and your senators.
Let me add to
that. Most of them don't know anything about human spaceflight, and they rely on one or two senators or congressmen that might have some knowledge. In the Senate, they rely a lot on John Glenn and Bill Nelson. And John Glenn and Bill Nelson may not have the best ideas. That's where you as a technician or an engineer or whatever, you need to be writing those letters. You need to be saying, you know, this is why I think this program needs to go through. This is why I think the budget needs to be increased. Be clear, concise. Don't insult them. Teach them.
Yeah, and
because somebody there reads this stuff.
What I was going
You know, it really does help. Go to the town hall meetings and teach them. And don't, and when you ask them, say, do you support Constellation? Do you support the new space? Do you support whatever? You know, don't take I support the space program as an answer. Get specifics.
And
say, well, what space program? Which one do you support?
You know, I would urge people to talk to service organizations, churches, synagogue,
yeah.
Rotary Club, all of that.
Well, that's what,
but
that's what I do with the lecture series. Is you go out and just educate people about human spaceflight. I don't do politics in my program, but they are more knowledgeable by the time we walk out. And if someone asks me, what are we going to do after the shuttle program, I'll say, I don't know. Constellation was killed. It's kind of up in the air, and... You know, I really don't know.
So another little hint, listeners, is if you're writing op-ed pieces and articles, this is, I guess, just my personal perspective. I know people will disagree. Don't go and publish them on extreme blogs.
No.
Because you lose everybody other than the choir of that extreme blog, and you get known for not, you know, being credible. So there's a lot of different places out there where you can publish credible, realistic things fairly. But if you go to either extreme, left or right, you discredit your message. And then the only people who pay attention are the people that are of a like choir mind that go to that blog. And that is not how you win friends, make friends, and influence people in a teaching moment. You don't do it by being an extremist. And
yeah, there's a guy who writes a blog on the Huffington Post about space matters.
Well, he's my good friend.
Huffington Post, you know, if you're not a liberal, you're like, you know, I would never go there.
Well, and so, I can tell you I'm not a liberal, and Rick is a good friend. He's on the show all the time. But, you know, to me, the Huffington Post has zero credibility. So
yeah.
I know to people of a different persuasion, you know, they would take issue with me on that, and they would say, no, it's got great articles and all that. Okay, well, that's fine. But for people who are thirsty for solid information and happen to not be of the nature of the Huffington Post, that's not where you want to go post your information. That's how I do things.
You can write your own blog. It's not hard to get a blog started.
No, it's five minutes.
That's what I've done with mine. And,
yeah. By the way, we're coming up on the end of the show. Tell us about your blog real quick.
Okay. My blog originally was started out as just a way of keeping our family and friends posted about how we were doing on travel. It's a lot easier than sitting down writing 150 emails. But when... the Obama announced his budget to kill Constellation, that's when I did my very first space post, or a political-type space post. And it's grown since then. I've been featured on NASAWatch.com, and not sometimes agreeably, but I've been featured on it.
Join the club.
And AmericanSpace.org and NASAEngineer.com. But, you know, it's become more and more of a space-related or human spaceflight-related blog, and I've found I've really enjoyed doing that and giving my opinions. I try very hard to not only give my opinion, but try to back it up with facts, because I don't like to get dinged, and nobody does, and I want to stay credible. And I welcome anybody that wants to come and comment. Just remember, it is a family site, so no cursing, no attacks or anything like that, because I'll delete you.
What's the URL again?
URL is www.rb-103.com. And I also am a contract blogger for Space Tech, and we cover just space history and technical issues and stuff like that. I've just started this thing. And that's at www.blog.spacetech, spacetech.org. And go ahead and check that place out too, and or you'll find it on the sidebar on my my website if you're looking for it.
If people want to get a hold of you, send you an email or a follow up, how do they do so, or do you want them to go through me?
They can send me a follow up. I'm at rocketman@rv-103.com.
Easy to remember.
Yeah.
And listeners, you can also comment on the blog, on the Space Show blog, so everybody can see what you're saying, and I will make sure Greg sees any comments that get posted there. What should we have talked about that we haven't as we wind the show down?
Well, I think we've talked to just about everything. NASA, the shuttle, and some of the space politics and stuff like that. I think I've pretty much put forward everything I wanted to put forward.
Do you have a favorite of which museum should get which shuttle?
Kennedy Space Center should get this, one of the shuttles, and of course the Smithsonian is already going to get Discovery.
Okay.
Third shuttle, I don't know. I let Huntsville or Johnson Space Center fight that one out.
What about a private museum? Do you think
what's that?
A private museum? Do you think it should go to a private museum or another space center?
I think it needs to go to another space center that is sponsored by the taxpayers. Taxpayers pay for those ships. It should be at a museum that is open to the general public, such as the Smithsonian or one of the visitor centers at the different space centers.
Well, so Johnson and Marshall, well, next to Marshall, has the Atlas, has the Saturn V, and
right.
My personal preference would be the shuttle goes in, you know, next to or close to the Saturn V. You know, if you're really going to museum it, I think that's what you need to do.
I agree.
And maintain it by the taxpayer, because otherwise you run the risk of having them deteriorate.
Yeah, and I know Delaware North is the one that runs the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Center, and they have done a fantastic job with the Saturn V Center.
Yeah, I've been there. It is fabulous.
Yeah.
But so has Davidson Center in Huntsville. That's an.
I haven't been there.
Oh, it's a fabulous display. It's very much like the one at the Kennedy Space Center. It is really incredible, and I would urge you to go see it sometime.
Well, we're in an RV. I'm sure we'll find our way there eventually. So I've been to Johnson Space Center. I've been to their Visitor Center, but I still prefer Kennedy Space Center. The Visitor Center there is just Delaware North has just done a fantastic job with that place, and I think they just got their contract renewed, and they're already planning for hoping to get a shuttle and planning an appropriate exhibit. They already have the shuttle launch experience there, which is quite a lot of fun, and if they end up building a facility that is on par with what they have done with the Saturn V rocket, the shuttle will be, and its people will be honored very well.
Did the alligators ever get to you at Kennedy Space Center?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. there's almost 10,000 alligators out there. There's some pretty big ones. I've seen them take down an entire deer before. And out at the launch pads, there's a pond in front of the building where the workforce would stay in when we've got a shuttle on the pad.
Yeah.
And at Pad B one night, it's kind of scary because you might get there at 4 in the morning. It just depends on how the hours of operation are going on while you're at the pad. And you get out, it's dark, you don't know if there's a gator hiding underneath one of the cars, and they hunt by ambush. But one of our tile techs one time, one of the big gators, who's about a 10-12 footer, for some reason decided he wanted to eat one of our tile techs. And the man ran from him, got up on the hood of a car, and the alligator's still trying to get to him. Someone else took a pickup truck and ran over that alligator twice trying to stop it and didn't faze it. It was just hell-bent on getting that technician. And security had to come out and shoot the thing.
What do they shoot an alligator with? My God, not a pistol. What do they use to shoot a gator?
I think they used a shotgun. I wasn't there for the shooting, but I figure a shotgun to the head's probably the best thing they use. But, you know, and it's a shame. I mean, nobody wants to kill any of the gators. But, you know, when they get aggressive like that against people, then, you know, they're going to have to be put down. And I think what they do is that they take the meat and they actually donate it to charity.
It's amazing the guy could outrun the thing to get to the car.
Well, he had a very short distance to get to the car, fortunately. If he had to run any further, well, you know, he would have been gator food. So.
Well, I understand if you zigzag, they can't zigzag if you're running away from it. They can only go in a straight line. Is there any truth, or is that a myth?
I it's like airbags. They save your lives, but do you really want to be there to test it out?
No, as I say, I just got to run faster than the guy I'm with. So,
that's right.
That's the key, is to be faster than the person you're with if you get chased by one.
There is.
You know, you see them all over the canals and everything, and they're maybe 3 feet long and all that, and they really don't look that mean or dangerous. And yet, then I pick up the Orlando Sentinel, and there's an article about a guy who tried to feed a 3-foot alligator, and he's minus his whole arm.
Yeah, a 3-footer can do that. And then, you know, when you start getting some of the back areas there at Kennedy Space Center, because it's right in the middle of a wildlife refuge.
Right, I know.
You're talking 10, 12-foot gators. And, I mean, they're huge. And I remember I used to go and take walks during my lunch break, and just to get out and enjoy the Florida sunshine. And I started going down the roadway that goes to the shuttle landing facility, and it's flanked by canals on both sides. And they had signs up telling you not to bother the alligators. When I would look at the alligators all lined up by the hundreds on the bank sunning themselves, and they were bigger than me, I'm thinking, why would I want to bother them? And I found a different place to go walk.
So has anyone polled the alligators on the demise of the shuttle, or do they have anything to say about this?
I don't think they have anything to say. So, you know, and security considers them part of the security force. Like I said, there's almost 10,000 of them out there. If you had some idiot terrorist trying to swim across Mosquito Lagoon or go through the swamps to try to get to the shuttle, that's a pretty potent force they're going to have to try to get past.
Good for the gators, employed by the U.S., for national security. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, drive your RLV safely and enjoy your travels, and let's see how all of this unfolds over the next coming months and the near-term couple of years. And I'm optimistic. I think we'll ultimately have a good human spaceflight program, but I think it's going to be pretty bumpy along the way.
I think we're in for some rough, dark times for a while, and I hope to be wrong. I really hope that we're flying before 10 years.
I do think we'll be flying before 10 years, but I don't think it'll be without hiccups and bumps along the way.
Right. But anyways, I've enjoyed tonight.
Well, I
get to come back again.
Absolutely, we'll stay in touch and keep us posted, and look forward to meeting you sometime in person, and thank you for doing an extra long space show program tonight.
All right, and I want to thank your listeners. I appreciate all the questions and for not throwing any stones.
And listeners, if you haven't had enough of politics by the time Friday comes along, Bob Zimmerman is back, and he is going to translate and interpret for us the meaning for space of our recent elections results from yesterday. So it'll be strictly towards space only. We're not going into any kind of general politics or anything like that. But if you want Bob's best guess opinions on how all of this will play out with U.S. space policy, Friday, 9:30 a.m. California time, that's the program to hear. And then one last note, and I'll let everybody go. Don't forget that Sunday is the end of daylight savings time at 2 a.m., whatever your time zone is in the United States. So we're going to turn our clocks back. So the 12 noon show on Sunday is standard time. So don't forget to make that change on November 7th. Thank you, Greg. And listeners, thank you for participating. Trent, thank you for calling in from Australia. And we will be in touch next show, Zimmerman, Friday morning. Goodbye, everybody.
And y'all have a good night tonight.
Thank you.